Hey there, my name is Betsy Woodruff. I'm a reporter with the Washington Examiner, and I'm here today with Daniel Strauss, who covers campaigns for Talking Points Memo. And our vision for the next 30 or 40 minutes of your internet lives is to go down four of the more interesting Senate races that are unfolding over this cycle and just kind of quickly highlight things that are interesting, stuff that's unusual. I don't know, sort of a drive-by blogging heads episode, if you will. Anything to add to the intro here, Daniel?
No, I think you actually covered it pretty well. Cool. You know, so let's do
All
it.
Right.
First one we're looking at is Mississippi, right?
Yeah. So Mississippi is a really fun race. Although we were chatting a little bit earlier about how there's been a lot of Mississippi news in the last couple weeks. For the uninitiated, for people who haven't been, you know, dedicating significant chunks of their waking lives to follow the adventures of the Senate Conservatives Fund in Mississippi, I think maybe the most interesting thing about this race is just the insane levels of oppo. Not even necessarily the effectiveness of a lot of the oppo that we're looking at, but just the quantity is really impressive. Do you have thoughts on that, Daniel?
Yeah, so I mean, I think BuzzFeed just posted something this afternoon on State Senator Chris McDaniel, his radio show. And, you know, as far as I can tell, that once upon a time, McDaniel, who's one of the favorite sons of these outside groups, he wanted to be sort of a radio superstar like Rush Limbaugh. So he said sort of bombastic and rather semi-outrageous things. And, of course, that wouldn't be something that your opposing campaign ignored if you decided to run for office. But for the most part, a lot of it hasn't really been that surprising. And when we ran into each other on the train the other day, you were making the case, you were making the case that nothing that's really come out sort of puts a nail in the coffin for McDaniel. And I'm inclined to agree. I mean, there are some semi-surprising things, and a lot of what TPM has covered are his comments on sort of race relations. But, you know, everyone I've talked to sort of scowls when I ask them about the effectiveness of that or how much that'll hurt McDaniel, and they say, you know, it's Mississippi. And they're right. The guy that McDaniel is challenging, apparently, I saw, according to the Weekly Standard, has a picture of Jefferson Davis in his office.
Yeah, right. I hate to sort of indulge in kind of crass stereotypes about people who live outside the Acela corridor. You know, I'm from Missouri originally. My family's from the South. But it's hard not to say, well, this is a Republican primary in Mississippi. I feel like George Bush's dog would be a competitive contender. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous thing to say, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, these kind of comments are not game changers here. And in fact, I was talking to Laura Van Overschelde, I hope I'm not butchering her name, the other day, who's the head of one of the big Tea Party groups in Mississippi. And let me see if I can find this quote she gave me. What she said was, "We here are not as politically correct as you guys are there," which, you know, makes sense, like, of course. But I think probably the McDaniel treasure trove, the main winners there is National Democrats. You know, I don't think we're going to see Cochran running on, hey, a conservative radio show host was too conservative, vote for me in the Republican primary. But I do think that if McDaniel is the nominee, it's going to be extremely helpful to National Democrats as far as saying, look at the Republicans' failed rebranding effort, you know, so much for reaching out to minorities, et cetera. And regardless of how compelling those arguments might be, I think it gives them a line of attack that they'll be able to use.
Yeah, I mean, there actually is, I think, still a Democrat in the race, Travis Childers, who's a former congressman. I haven't seen any activity by Childers at all. Maybe I missed it, but I haven't seen him too active yet. And I guess that sort of tells me two things, that he's lying in waiting, or you know, his entire purpose is to play spoiler when and where Democrats think they can. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you on this, Betsy, what do you think would be enough to stick the nail in the coffin for McDaniel or even Cochran? Because it seems like we're sort of in a stasis period. And the recent polling I've seen of that race has had McDaniel gaining on Cochran, but Cochran's still in the lead.
I think the potential things McDaniel could have said, or the things that could be out there that might hurt him the most in a Republican primary, would be if he made comments about spending, especially military spending, that didn't really make sense. You know, the Cochran people are already going after him for saying that, for not having a very coherent answer to the question on military spending. He's definitely a self-styled deficit hawk, but if you don't have something sensible to say about that, especially when you're talking about cuts the way he does, I think that could be a problem. I haven't spent any time going through old radio shows of McDaniel's, but
which sounds delightful, by the way.
I know. There are, like, some really sad unpaid interns somewhere who've just been having, like, the worst 3 weeks of their life. Maybe the Intrepid reporters are finding these things themselves, in which case, hats off.
I think it's probably a combination. You know, and yeah. I was one of those interns once upon a time. Yeah. It's definitely, like, one of those things where you gotta be like, this is so worth it in the long.
You know, it's God's work. Somebody has to do it. It's important. You're going to run for office and you have a radio show. Somebody should go through everything you said on your radio show because this is America and we have democracy.
Yeah, by the way, I wanted to ask you about this too. So Mike Rogers, the chairman, the outgoing chairman of the House Intel Committee.
Yeah.
So he's retiring and he was a rising star, and he actually is really interesting because he could have run for Senate and was sort of considered a heavyweight for running for Senate in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And he was also mentioned as a possible FBI director for President Obama, which is a weird sort of dichotomy. Mm-hmm. But he picked neither. He decided to retire, and he apparently wants to do a radio show. Why is it that lawmakers continue to want to do this radio show thing and then run for office?
I have no idea. And I think the career trajectory there for Rogers is especially interesting because it seems much more typical that you have someone who's sort of a bombastic media personality and then goes into politics. But, you know, I'm sure there have been, you know, plenty of examples of politicians going from a place as prominent as Rogers to getting a radio show, but I can't think of any off the top of my head. I mean, maybe there's something therapeutic about talk radio after years and years of sensibility and filteredness. I could see how that would be extremely gratifying. You know, Ron Paul has the Ron Paul channel, which I have not watched, which apparently has some great quality programming.
And then there's, of course, Joe Scarborough, who
right.
That's right. Used to be a congressman, unless you watched any second of MSNBC ever.
Cable news, woohoo! So. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a calculus there.
So you were saying that the thing that really would have to bring either Cochran or McDaniel down would have to be something that's hyper-liberal.
Right. I think the lines of attack that Cochran has as far as McDaniel's comments about Katrina relief funds that have been, where McDaniel said things to the effect of he's not positive if he would have taken it, or he's been a little bit wishy-washy on that at different points. Mm-hmm. I think that's a vulnerability for him. I think, you know, as far as other potential things that McDaniel could say that would be game changers, I think if there's something really horrible, it could be, but it has to be something that goes beyond just political correctness. So, for instance, on the radio show, for blogging head listeners out there who haven't been following this with, you know, surgical level of detail, one of the things that McDaniel said was, if I have to learn Mexican, the only word I know in Mexican is mamacita. I think that means hey, hot mama. I mean, this isn't like high-level political discourse. This is just people mouthing off. That's the kind of thing where if you're running for Senate in perhaps Virginia or New Hampshire or purpley-bluish states, that could be a problem. But I just can't imagine a universe where that's an issue in a Mississippi Republican primary. I think if he had said something really terrible, like something undeniably ugly, racist, awful, I think that would be a big problem. But I don't think he would have. I don't think McDaniel would have run. I don't think the groups that have endorsed him would have endorsed him if there's something like that out there.
And there doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But it's really, I mean, the one advantage to Cochran doing this is that he gets to keep the pressure up on McDaniel, and he gets to stay on the offensive mm-hmm. in one way or another.
Right, and also this is, and also this is presuming that the radio stories are coming from Cochran's camp, which we don't know.
Right,
you know, it's
right. Mean, you know, Andrew Kaczynski has reported on a lot of that, and that's part of his beat, which is sort of resurfacing audio and video of lawmakers. Yeah.
Assuming that this is oppo that the Cochran camp is leaking, which we don't know, which is a pretty big assumption, it's very helpful to the Cochran camp.
So,
you know,
so my one thing that my colleague Dylan Scott was ranting about today was actually how there's this whole other sub story of campaign reporting that reporters are most of the time unable to report on, where campaigns are pushing oppo and that whole scene there. So like, illustrating why a campaign or a campaign committee like the DSCC, I'm just naming a random committee, is pushing up on. It's obviously something we see a lot of and we can spot, but the rest of the world can't really see that because reporters want to keep these sources healthy and these lines of communication open.
Right. You don't want to make fun of the people who are giving you good material.
Right. And even the guys who are giving you bad material, I think that's an indicator too.
Mm-hmm.
Like when a campaign gives you something awful, I think that says something about how good the other candidate is.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think there's any remedy to that? Any like?
You know, I feel like the whole structure of oppo leaks to reporters is kind of a fact of political journalism. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think probably the main thing from sort of a reporting perspective is just that you're not relying on oppo leaks to get stories. You know, that you're not, you know, sitting around waiting for campaigns to email you, and that you're, I don't know, judicious about only using good stuff. You know, not jumping up and down as soon as you get an email from someone on a campaign committee. I think the story of how oppo leaks work is really interesting. And I would love to see like a 10,000 word long read on how some of these machinations function. Because it is something that, like, you know, if you're a reporter, you see this happening all the time. You know what it looks like. You read a story and it's like, I bet that was an oppo leak. Although you don't actually know.
And it's
kind of a rude thought to have, like, oh, look at that person, that reporter must be friends with someone, when, you know, definitely not certainly the case. But I would love to know more about how all that stuff works. I think America Rising, that's the conservative group that's doing a lot of this, it's become more effective. We talked about this when we did the last Blogging Heads. It's especially interesting as part of this whole, you know, terrain. But we digress.
But by the way, the last point on McDaniel, honestly, Betsy, I think Democrats should take that race far more seriously than, you know, just as a way to just sort of needle Republicans here. Because if McDaniel does get elected, that gives the ultra-conservative Ted Cruz wing of the GOP another vote. And you don't need a majority of those guys. You just need two or three more to shift the chamber and shift Congress in general farther in one direction.
Right, exactly. I can't imagine, as it stands right now, based on what we know about McDaniel and Cochran, I can't imagine a Democrat winning that race. But, you know, that we say that every campaign cycle, and, you know, there's always an exception. So yeah, I think the extent to which McDaniel would be a huge win for Tea Party conservatives has probably been, is probably understated. It would be a really big deal if he wins. Mm-hmm. And especially, you're right, like, for just for the composition of the Senate. Cool.
Yeah.
Good talk.
All right, we got to go on to, what did you want to talk about? You wanted to talk about Kentucky next?
Right. Next, I think, a story from Kentucky that we didn't hear a lot on a national level over the last 2 weeks, but that I think is really interesting, is connected to the Grimes-McConnell race, obviously. And the story, it's a little bit complicated, and it's unusual, and it's the kind of thing that doesn't make for a great, you know, 200-word blog post, but it's fascinating to me. And I'll give sort of the 30-second elevator version of this, and then we can talk about it a little bit more. So I think his name's John Arnold, was a member of the Kentucky legislature who sexually harassed 3 women in the state house. He was a Democrat. He resigned during, you know, when these allegations were coming out. Obviously, if you're literally spanking your employees, you probably shouldn't have a job as an elected official. Hooray, America. He's not in the state house anymore. But he had a hearing before a Kentucky Ethics Commission, and the commission has 9 seats. 1 seat is vacant, and at his ethics hearing, when the commission was deciding whether or not to fine him for the sexual harassment, there were only 5 members of the commission present. Now, you need 5 votes to fine this guy, so they would have needed a majority of the seats, and at this specific ethics commission hearing, they would have needed all 5 people to vote to fine Arnold. 4 of the 5 members of the commission voted to fine Arnold. 1 member did not, and because the 1 member who was present didn't vote to fine Arnold, Arnold got off without getting fined. Now, the reason that all this, and that person, by the way, was Elmer George. The reason all this is connected to the Senate race is because Arnold is a Grimes donor. Elmer George is a maxed out Grimes donor. And Elmer George was appointed to this ethics commission by Greg Stumbo, who is an ally of Grimes. And he was also, you know, he was there when she rolled out her campaign, etc. So the McConnell campaign basically spent a lot of time, and I think this is a valid point, saying that how can Allison Leonard and Grimes say she's a champion for women? How can she say she's, you know, really a person to look to fight the war on women when she didn't return donations that she got from these guys, and when she wasn't critical of the member of the commission who supported her and who also took the vote to keep the guy from getting fined. Now, that's not the entire story. The rest of the story is Grimes met with 2 of the 3 women who were harassed. They told her that they supported her and that they wanted her to keep the donations and use them to try to beat Mitch McConnell. Grimes put out a release saying that. Valid counterpoint. And then it just sort of has kind of continued this way. And then it got a little bit more national play in the last few days. I wrote a story about it for The Examiner. National Review did an item about it. The Washington Free Beacon has done an item about it. So not a huge amount of national play, but some. And then yesterday, Grimes called for another commission hearing, basically saying the first hearing that happened wasn't good enough. The women in the state house deserve more. So the Ethics Commission should reconvene and go after Arnold again. I don't know what the parliamentary procedure, like how the parliamentary procedure works then, if you can have another commission hearing. I don't know if there are double jeopardy rules. It's still kind of unfolding, but it's a really interesting story. At the same time, though, it's a tricky thing to report on because there's a bunch of different moving parts, and because, you know, obviously nobody really wants to accuse a prominent member of state government of being on the side of sexual harassers. You know, that would be nuts. So one thing that I would be curious about from your perspective, Daniel, is, does it seem unusual that the story didn't get more national play, or do you think it makes sense that it kind of stayed as a state issue? And then
I think it's unusual. Yeah, I do think it's unusual. The funny thing about this is that I can remember reading about the original sexual harassment charges and all of that going on in the state legislature mm-hmm. back in 2013 and trying to figure out a way to write something on it, and it just didn't happen. Honestly, I think this is one of the symptoms of this is twofold. One of it is that it is really complicated, and you spelled it out really well. But it is, and I, you know, this part, some of these things have been flagged to mm-hmm. me, and it's just hard to. It doesn't pass the unfortunate test of the internet, which right. is, you know, if you can't explain it in 3 seconds or less, you might want to pause before figuring
right.
it out.
And it's not very tweetable,
but
you know,
right.
It's something that would be very easy to write in a way that I think is unfair. Like the easy thing to do is just have a really sensational headline, but that's also not very helpful because it is, you know, it's a complex, messy issue. You know, it's not as simple as war on women. No, there's a Democrat war on women, which is how campaigns tend to phrase these things.
Right. And that's how, if the role was reversed, that's likely how Democrats would be pushing this.
Right. So,
from what you've said here, what's fascinating about this is how it will play locally, mm-hmm. and it's just a really interesting character study for me to watch Grimes, how she's handled mm-hmm. this. I mean, she hasn't run away from it. It doesn't sound like she's attacked McConnell and said, you know, this is complete oppo. You're just trying to peg me on this. She's really tried. It sounds like she's tried to really sort of handle all angles here. It does put her in a weird position.
Yeah, and to be fair, she did criticize the McConnell campaign for. You know, one statement she put out said McConnell campaign goes after Grimes before knowing all the facts. So it's not as simple as her sort of keeping her hands clean of any electoral politics concerns.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know how effective that's going to be.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, it doesn't say, like, how do you make a campaign ad out of this? You know, how do you translate this to like a 30-second TV spot? I don't know. But it's really interesting. And I think it raises a lot of interesting questions.
It does sort of. And I think the most crucial part in all of this is that these women said, we want you to keep the donations, mm-hmm. which kind of puts it back into Grimes's court. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. She could still say, I don't want this tainted money mm-hmm. or
blood
something.
Blood money.
Frankly, Grimes outraised McConnell in the last quarter. Yeah. She just reported fundraising.
She can afford to return, $3,000 or $4,000.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, you know what, though?
It is hard to...
One thing I forgot to include is that the member of the commission who voted not to fine this guy, his son works on Grimes' campaign. A Grimes source confirmed that for me.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So
see, but these are all these ties are really hard to explain,
right,
and this is
right.
this is a lot of the problems with a lot of the attacks going yeah. on this campaign cycle. We've talked about this before. Campaigns are so tight-lipped and tightly oriented. It's real, and the requirement for something to be effective is for like a headline mm-hmm. to be really snappy and punchy.
Right.
It's really hard to. Get attention to something like this.
Right.
And I don't think, it does not sound, I mean, this sounds like something that warrants more attention, is just fascinating in general.
Yeah.
Warrants more coverage.
And it was especially...
It's especially during a month where we're all talking about women's issues,
mm-hmm.
women's rights and equality
right.
and equal pay.
And sort of touching on what you said earlier... If it was a Republican version of this, if Alison Lundgren Grimes was a male Republican in the exact same situation, I think this would be on MSNBC every day. I feel like...
Well, I don't know about... I mean, I don't know
yeah.
about that. I still think it's too complicated to really explain in an
mm-hmm.
effective way.
Yeah.
I have not seen it on Fox, but granted, the Fox TV in our newsroom is directly behind me, so...
Bummer, man. That must be so rough.
Yeah.
So
I don't see it most days.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure, but, it is one of those things that I think is sort of a casualty of the news environment we're in. At the same time, though, it's still a little hard for me to even think that if this did get widespread attention, that it would be a damning thing for right. Grimes. Right. There are, like you said, there are too many links in the chain.
Yeah. I think maybe the like more interesting part of this story is that it becomes problematic for the war on women narrative that Democrats nationally have mm-hmm. used very successfully. Because that same week when this story was really unfolding, the Grimes campaign sent out an email about Huffington Post story reporting on a Mitch McConnell staffer, I think, retweeting a Washington Times op-ed that they argued was the most sexist op-ed they'd ever seen. So it's kind of interesting just contrasting those situations where you have, okay, a staffer retweets an op-ed, therefore war on women. At the same time, a prominent donor votes not to fine another donor. The campaign is silent. Nothing about the war on women comes up. So,
right.
And I think that's why the story at least was so interesting to me, because of the way that a lot of the political narratives that are easiest to use and simplest and most effective, it doesn't mesh with those very well at all.
But do you think, I mean, coverage aside, do you think this shows that Grimes is waging some kind of
Grimes
secret
hates
war
women.
On women?
No, of course not. No, of course not. And I think it would be ridiculous to say that.
Which is what Dems would say
right.
if
the But at
the
same
war
time,
reversed,
right, which is what Democrats would say, you know, and you'd be getting millions of emails about it. At the same time, I think perhaps why this story is interesting is because so many of the stories that we do hear about women's issues are about things that might not necessarily have an enormous impact on specific individual women. Whereas a sexual harassment hearing, we actually have female victims. We actually have a perpetrator. Like these, this is a very concrete, hard and fast instance of women feeling like they were in danger. Whereas a Washington right. Times op-ed, and you know, I haven't read the entire Washington Times op-ed. I don't have an opinion. Is it the most sexist thing ever written? Whatever. But you know, it's hard not to say if you had to say one of these situations is indicative of a war on women, one of these situations is less indicative of a war on women. I think it's hard to argue that that the Times op-ed is more relevant to this war on women conversation than a sexual harassment story is, I think.
I think yeah. so. And, I think there's a better opportunity for debate.
Mm-hmm.
on the state of women, how they should be treated, right. and how a woman candidate would appropriately respond in this situation.
Right. And this isn't to go after
whoever's handling the
Twitter. Exactly. And this isn't to defend McConnell or go after Grimes or make any sort of comment on how the electoral politics ought to unfold. This is more to say one of these stories is more interesting than the other story. Therefore, it surprises me that this interesting story, which isn't very cut and dry, which doesn't really fit with a lot of simple media narratives, hasn't gotten more attention.
Well, Betsy, you're so... I mean, think about it here. Think about, like, even The New Yorker runs, you know, 1,000-word stories on things. It's an incredibly influential magazine, but its influence in terms of readership or clicks is tiny compared to, like, BuzzFeed.
That's true.
Or... other sites out mm-hmm. there. It's so sad that, like, you know, and this is, I think we're seeing this more and more. One of the most important topics, I think, in America right now is poverty and proper journalism on poverty mm-hmm. at the urban level. But we're not going to see a huge amount of that because it's not very clicky. It's kind of a bummer, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, And this whole let's be depressed about the state of contemporary journalism because nobody's writing about X issue, I think is a really interesting, important conversation. But it feels like the end of that conversation is almost always either A, journalists are bad at their jobs, or B, American people are illiterate and don't click good journalism, and I'm an old man waving my fist at a cloud. And I don't know which side of that I come down on. What do you think?
Right. I don't really
yeah.
know. I It's kind of hard to tell here.
And you know, the caveat would be that, you know, along with a lot of 27 things that you remember if you were born in the year 1989, there's also a lot of really good, smart, interesting journalism on BuzzFeed. So right. I think it's, I like BuzzFeed. However, if all you read are like, you know, listicles, maybe you have some priorities to reevaluate.
Read more.
There are stories out there that are worth your time. Cool. Yeah. So, speaking of great stories, you want to talk about
great stories
next on the agenda?
New Hampshire.
Okay. Done.
New Hampshire and Scott Brown.
Which actually is a really good story.
I have to be honest. Well, it is. It's. I mean, the most fascinating thing is how Scott Brown's sort of somersaults and backflips to become New Hampshire.
Yeah.
His latest thing was saying that he was born in Maine. He's practically grown up in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And Jean Shaheen, he's saying, is basically actually a senator from Massachusetts, which is bizarre.
Yeah. I feel like maybe there were some rhetorical flubs there. Maybe that could have been handled a little more gracefully. Yeah, it's amusing. I think I love this race.
The thing about it is that he's polling pretty well, and his fundraising has been
okay.
You
know what? That's what surprised me. Let's talk about fundraising because I don't think either of us are like huge fundraising wonks, but. I dusted off, you know, my Google, and Brown made $275,000 in 16 days. It seems pretty good.
I would like to make
$275,000 in 16 days.
Right. It is especially good given that he's not going to be supported by these super powerful outside groups.
SCF maybe is probably AFP, not going to bend over
I think actually, but... Right, but Senate Conservatives Fund is not going to support Scott mm-hmm. Brown. Club for Growth is not going to support Scott Brown. So that is pretty good. I still, personally, I don't know about you, Betsy, but I still have my doubts if this is anything more than epic trolling. But that might be a little too optimistic.
Speaking of trolling and watching this race, haven't there been reports, talks about Brown potentially mulling a 2016 bid? I feel like he's hinted at that. He went to Iowa. Assuming that that's something he's thinking about, which I have no knowledge of, then this race is not only helpful, but basically imperative. Obviously, that's being very speculative. But just in terms of, if we're using the term trolling, there's definitely a lot of value added for Brown here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he floated that, or what? I'm speechless here. I actually don't really. You really got me. I really don't know.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, of course we don't, because Brown's not going to be like, hey, I think I'm going to run for Senate because I'm bored as I'm waiting to kick off my 2016 bid.
Which would be a bad idea because you have the scent of loserdom on you already.
Right.
I guess you get your name out there, but it's better to have lost one race and then run for president, because most presidents, I think, at least in the 20th century, lose one race at least and then go on and win.
Right. Did Obama?
I think this would be different. Yeah. Oh, Obama definitely. Yeah. He lost. He actually lost to my congressman, Bobby Rush.
No kidding.
And if any of my friends ever run for president, I'm going to tell them, you know, you kind of want to lose now instead of, you know, because when you get up there, it's better. Like John Huntsman, I don't think ever lost a race. So his time came at the wrong time.
Well, you know the natural logical conclusion of what you're saying is that we all should be excited for President Rick Santorum.
President Rick Santorum. Reagan ran what, three times, I think. You never know, and the runner up is in a fine spot. I still have my doubts about Santorum, having been a Santorum beat reporter, but
that's a good beat, though.
it would be exciting to cover him again.
Yeah, totally.
But with Brown, what do you think about, I mean, what do you think is really going on here? Is Brown just goofing off and trolling? Is he a serious candidate?
I think he's very serious. Yeah. I think it's certainly a good faith effort to win a Senate seat. You know, I don't know Brown personally. I've never talked to him for more than like 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. Based on what I've read about him, he seems like the kind of person who says sort of goofy stuff, you know, a little bit of a bro. And thus it would be easy to sort of cherry pick comments and then say, this isn't a serious campaign, but I really think it is. Indicators that it's a serious campaign would be, you know, clearly something he's been thinking about for a while. You know, when he moved from Massachusetts to New Hampshire, he's not a Steve Stockman. He didn't wait until, you know, 30 seconds before the filing deadline to even indicate he was interested in running. We knew he was interested in running. He has raised significant money, which means there are people with money who take his candidacy seriously. And then just sort of on its face, he's polling pretty well. I think before he even officially, let me look at this. I think before he officially announced that he was going to run, he was down by just 6. And that's crazy that like when you're not running for Senate, you're only losing by 6 points. So I think,
yeah, but at the same time, he was not, I mean, he has dragged out his announcement as much as possible. There was breaking news about he's going to announce his exploratory committee. He's going to announce that he's moving beyond his exploratory committee. He's going to announce the day that he's moving on. It was pretty clear what he was doing.
Not very subtle.
It was not a surprise.
Yeah, not very coy.
Right.
Yeah, but still. But it's still interesting. You know, yeah, like without going on TV, without going on the internet, without doing ads, only down by 6. Like, this is clearly a candidacy that has to be taken seriously. It's a race that has to be taken seriously. And also, you know, I'm not an expert on New Hampshire or on the polling in this specific Senate race, but according to a WMUR Grant State poll, Shaheen is under 50 in basically every head-to-head Republican matchup. So, you know, I have trouble at this point.
Against Bob Smith, I'm a little doubtful. The other Senate candidate from a different state running in New Hampshire.
I think that poll looked at Brown.
It does spell outliers still indicate.
Yeah,
something.
So that poll looked at Brown, and the poll put Shaheen leading Brown 45-39. So, you know, it's still a significant window, but it's within the margin of error, and it's under 50. I think the race is interesting. It's no Arkansas.
All right, I want to go over Arkansas really quickly.
Let's do that.
That's okay. Speaking of outliers, there are three or four polls out that show Mark Pryor ahead of Tom Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird because Tom Cotton is the candidate.
Right.
He's the Republican.
Right. He is
supposed to
recruit. Yeah.
Right. He is the man. And I have friends who really, really like him. And you know, I'd love to know what you say. Think quickly, but my thoughts are basically that if those polls are to be true, and two of them I think were from Democratic leaning organizations, there is just sort of a devil you know appeal to congressional candidates and Senate candidates.
Something that's really interesting.
And the other thing. And the other thing is that I can't think of, I mean, one thing I was pressed to think of today and in general is, where are the optimistic candidates? Where are the guys who are like, tomorrow's going to be awesome, guys, and you just stick with me and things will get better? All I hear a lot of the time is, you know, vote for me because that other guy is really bad.
Yeah, all right. Agreed. Something is interesting to me about Tom Cotton's candidacy is that I think it's surprising that we don't hear more about any other Republicans running in that race. I feel like you pick almost any red state Democrat who's vulnerable, and the Republican primary is at least interesting. In Louisiana, you've got Colonel Rob Manis, who doesn't seem to be a competitive candidate, but is at least an interesting candidate. You know, he's got a little bit of out of state backing. In North Carolina, you've got Bob Tillis, but you also have Greg Brannon. You know, that's an interesting race to watch. But it surprises me about Cotton. Number one, it's surprising that that as soon as he entered, everyone just assumed he was going to be the nominee. And I think that's a very safe assumption. And number two, what surprises me is that we haven't seen more Cotton hate. Cotton is basically the antithesis of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. He defends the Iraq War. He was the vocal guy opposing the Amash Amendment. A friend of mine was complaining on Facebook a couple months ago about how when Tom Cotton was in Harvard, he wanted to ban smoking on campus or something. And I think what's interesting to me about his candidacy is that it seems to suggest that the, you know, quote unquote liberty movement within the GOP, meaning folks whose you know, galvanizing energy comes from concerns about Bush foreign policy, NSA stuff, that those right. folks have not been more vocally anti-Cotton. You know, it surprises me that
right.
you just don't hear Cotton talking about foreign policy at all. It surprises me that Republicans aren't libertarian leaning Rand Paul Republicans aren't really miffed about Cotton, because I think he certainly gives those folks a lot of material to work with.
Right. Yeah, Maine establishment Republicans better pray that Tom Cotton pulls this off, because that's going to give libertarian candidates and the far right guys a lot of reason to primary guys in the future. It is surprising, I don't think there's a huge Tea Party presence in Arkansas, actually. Mm-hmm. I think like West Virginia, it's one of these states that was a red state Democratic stronghold for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's why we haven't seen it take root there. And the problems in those states aren't necessarily conducive to the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, they like spending. They're not wealthy states. Right. And they've had Democratic control for a mm-hmm. while. And the prior name is a very popular name. Right. They have a lot of, I mean, if you're an Arkansas Democrat or an Arkansas voter, you probably feel some pride about Democrats, mm-hmm. The Clintons, for what it's worth. Right. I mean, the prior family.
And I don't even know if you need to throw in it for what it's worth with the Clintons. I mean, arguably the most powerful political family in America right now is from Arkansas. It's huge. And they're Democrats.
Are the Clintons?
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Right.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I mean, yeah, so Bill Clinton. So, we'll see what happens there. You might see an upset. It'd be weird. Mm-hmm. I have to rush now. Betsy, thanks so much for talking with me on this. Let's do this again. And let's hope more characters come out, more good attack lines.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
All right. See you soon.
All right. Thanks, Betsy. Bye.